أوسلو لم يتضمن لا كلمة إنهاء الاحتلال، إنهاء الاستيطان، ولا كلمة دولة فلسطينية مستقلة.
Paris wanted to see a Palestinian state in Gaza and an Israeli-Palestinian Jordanian condominium in the West Bank.
It is not possible for a small country like Norway to play an asymmetric role. It has to be a role according to Israel's rules of the game.
Present at the signing ceremony was former US Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, chief architect of the peace between Egypt and Israel. Kissinger's approach was to make only small demands and to build from there. Arafat picked up on this step-by-step strategy, and as early as 1974, his Palestinian Liberation Organization approved a plan to aim for a foothold in the region, administered by a Palestinian authority, rather than historic Palestine. In the same year, the Arab League summit officially designated the PLO as the sole representative of the Palestinian people.
حق منظمة التحرير في أن تقود نضال الشعب الفلسطيني.
نقترب أكثر من نهج الواقعية، وهذا حتى أكون أمين للتاريخ، كان نهج ياسر عرفات اللي كانوا يسموه وقتها، يعني يعطوه كل الألقاب، مرة يسموه انتهازية، مرة يسموه براغماتية أكثر من اللازم.
In 1974, Arafat, known to his colleagues as Abu Ammar, addressed the United Nations. For the Palestinians and for the PLO, the event represented recognition for the Palestinian struggle.
إنها لمناسبة هامة أن يعود بحث قضية فلسطين إلى هيئة الأمم المتحدة.
The PLO gained stature at the UN, but it continued to reject Security Council resolutions 242 and 338. The resolutions demanded that Israel withdraw within what was called secure and recognized borders. But they did not precisely require Israel to withdraw to all land it occupied before the Six-Day War in 1967.
As far as the United States is concerned, any peace negotiations must be based on Security Council resolutions 242 and 338. We would strongly oppose any attempt to change.
These two resolutions were the framework for the 1978 Camp David Accords. The Accords called not for a Palestinian state, but for what was termed Palestinian autonomy.
بعهد بيغن عام 1977 اللي اقترح حكم ذاتي للفلسطينيين وعاصمة الحكم الذاتي بيت لحم وقوة شرطة يتم تسليحها من إسرائيل.
أدرك الإسرائيليون منذ ذلك الوقت أنه قد يأتي اليوم الذي سوف يتفاوض فيه الإسرائيليون مع الفلسطينيين لإقامة حكم ذاتي.
From its stronghold in South Lebanon in 1977, the PLO decided to explore the possibility of talks with Israel.
أخذنا أول مرة قرارات بأنه نبدأ حوار ولقاءات مع أطراف إسرائيلية. حقيقة كان أبو عمار بيساند هذا التوجه بقوة، وكان في آخرين في قيادة المنظمة بأيدوا مثل هذا التوجه بقوة.
Mahmoud Abbas says in his book The Secret Channels that this dialogue was with the Israeli forces that supported peace and with the Sephardic Jews. In March 1978, Israel invaded South Lebanon. The United Nations responded by deploying a peacekeeping force into South Lebanon. Known as UNIFIL, part of this force was made up of Norwegian troops.
I had visited for the first time as part as a Norwegian soldier
visiting the UNIFIL forces in Lebanon. I came with friends through Israel.
Den norske bataljonssjefen tog noen dager senere imot resten av styrken I Israel.
I det norske bevoktede området har det vært vansker for FN-styrkene fra første stund. Grupper av palestinske guerillasoldater har forsøkt å trenge gjennom de norske FN-stillingene hittil uten særlig hell.
Norway contributed approximately 1,000 soldiers, and of course the security of those soldiers was a very important concern to us. We were one of the first Western countries who established what we described at the time as working contacts with the PLO in that context. Mr. Knut Frydenlund, who was Minister of Foreign Affairs, Thorvald Stoltenberg was the Deputy Minister, State Secretary. He followed the situation very closely at the time.
No one is afraid of Norway, and that's the gift. What makes us weak in the traditional meaning is our strength when it comes to serve the peace.
كانت النرويج بلد صهيوني بامتياز بدليل انه من داخل البرلمان بهذاك الوقت كان اعضاء البرلمان 157 عضو 87 عضو منهم كانوا بجمعيه اسمها جمعيه اصدقاء اسرائيل النرويج صدقيني كان اصعب دوله في العالم اصعب من امريكا لاستقبال الفلسطينيين كان في شخصيات موجوده في الحكومه وفي الجيش وفي الاجهزه الامنيه مستعده ان تخدم اسرائيل لا لشيء فقط خدمة لإسرائيل يعني بدون أي مقابل.
Norway was more supportive of Israel than many of the others, and I think that than any of the other European states. There are several reasons, but one of the most important was that the Norwegian Labour Party and the Norwegian Trade Union, they saw this state of Israel as a socialist experiment. Almost a kind of social democratic social state like the one we have in Norway.
In the late 1970s, there was a common bond of socialist ideology between Norway's Labour Party and its namesake in Israel. One of the key players in this special relationship was a prominent Labour Party member of Norway's parliament, Johan Jürgen Holst.
Mr. Holst was the first person at the political level to meet Mr. Arafat. He was deputy minister and state secretary of the Ministry of Defense. He came to Beirut and traveled on to Israel in July, I think it was, in 79. He met with Yasser Arafat, and Yasser Arafat invited the whole group to a very pleasant dinner. Mr. Holst had very close contact with the Israelis, and that aspect of Mr. Holst made him even more interesting to Mr. Arafat. Mr. Arafat's interest in Norway was really over contact with Israel.
Ved at det har fått veltet inn over seg hele konflikten I Midtøsten. Så før man har fått en mer alminnelig løsning på Midtøsten-konflikten, det vanskelig å se at man skal få en endelig og varig løsning.
Bisudfi Holst kunt altaqitu kan naib wazir difa' wa ja'a ila Beirut wa zara mu'assasat Samad allati kuntu ana mas'ulan anha hinama zara quwwatihim almawjuda fi janub Lubnan.
In 1979, the Shah of Iran fled into exile. Israel lost an ally and a major oil supplier. The United States asked Norway to guarantee to sell its North Sea oil to Israel. Concerned about repercussions for its UN troops in Lebanon, Norway sent its diplomat Hans Longva to seek assurances from Arafat.
Mr. Arafat, after reflecting only for a few split seconds, he said, I will have no objection to such a Norwegian guarantee to Israel on one condition. When I need a secret back channel to Israel, you provide it.
Yasser Arafat wanted the Norwegians to act as intermediary between himself and Israel.
The Norwegians and the Norwegian government were just shocked to hear the message coming back from Arafat. So from 1979 and every year from there onwards, the Norwegians tried to set up a secret back channel between the PLO and Israel. But Israel were absolutely not willing at all to listen to anything that a Norwegian could come up with from Arafat and the PLO.
In 1982, the PLO lost its base in Lebanon. Palestinian fighters were forced to depart following the Israeli invasion of Lebanon 3 months earlier. A US brokered deal led to Arafat and his entourage moving to Tunisia.
It was actually an invitation from Arafat to my predecessor as foreign minister, Knut Frydenlund, and myself. I have been defense minister. And we went in 1982 for New Year's Eve with Arafat in Tunis at that time. Arafat asked us directly if we could help him getting a direct contact between PLO and the Israeli Labour Party. And I was at that time a member of the Assembly of the Socialist International. And it turned out to be a strong interest in the Socialist International for trying to contribute to normalization of the relationship between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
To help with his charm offensive, Arafat turned to senior PLO member Issam Sattawi to act as his main go-between.
Arafat appointed Dr. Sattawi, and he came here, visited me, because I should take care of this from the Norwegian side. And I had a very good impression of him.
I believe that the PLO has been the greatest achievement of our suffering people. I believe that the PLO is the most needed object. But a PLO...
And then we should meet in Albufeira. There was the Socialist International had its assembly meeting in Albufeira in Portugal. And then there was some shooting suddenly. And we rushed out in the lobby. And there was Sattawi, Dr. Sattawi, killed, shot down.
Issam Sattawi lay where he'd been killed by a lone gunman who pumped 5 shots into his chest.
It has never been clearly verified who ordered the assassination of Sattawi. But the motive appears to be because he was talking to the Israelis on Arafat's behalf.
Dr. Sattawi took his own position. He did swim against the stream in face of great objection and danger.
Arafat continued a double game. On the one hand, seeking discreet diplomatic channels to Israel via the Norwegians, while on the other hand, publicly maintaining a revolutionary rhetoric.
أبو عمار قال لي هذه فاتحة خير يا عمار بدي إياك بهدوء تشتغل مع ستولتنبرغ تحديدا بهدوء إلى أن يعني لكن بدك تكون عارف إنه شغلة ليست سهلة لأنه ستولتنبرغ ما زال عنده مواقف داعمة لإسرائيل حزب العمال ما زال حزبا داعما لإسرائيل لكن نحن يعني هدفنا أن نبدأ بأن نجعلهم أصدقائنا أيضا وبعدين بتطلعوا على معلومات احنا المهم نعطيهم معلومات رئيس أبو عمار كان يعطيني معلومات باستمرار وكنت أوصلها للخارجية بعد ما استلم ستولتنبرغ.
20 years on, Thorvald Stoltenberg will not betray the secrecy of conversations between the PLO and Israel.
We tried to prepare for contact and negotiations between the PLO authorities and the Israeli Labour Party. We started there, and we would very much like to try to follow up.
Who were the people from the Israeli Labour Party that you were contacting? Mr. Shimon Peres or
no,
other people?
I promised never to tell anyone. I have not told anyone. And I'm not even telling you. No, part of my success in life is not coming from what I say, but from all the things I didn't say.
In the mid-80s, the Labour Party in Israel formed a coalition government with Yitzhak Shamir's Likud Party. Shamir gave a nod and a wink for Likud member Moshe Amarav to hold secret talks with Palestinian politician Faisal al-Husseini in Jerusalem. Discussion centred on PLO recognition of Israel, autonomy on the West Bank, and a federal relationship with Jordan. The so-called Amarav-Husseini plan became a model for the subsequent Oslo Accords years later. But all that was soon dwarfed by the outbreak of the First Intifada. A Palestinian uprising which took both Israel and the PLO by surprise.
Stop the riots and let's talk.
باختصار الانتفاضة الشعبية الأولى جعلت الاحتلال يدخل في مرحلة أنه بدأ يخسر وإسرائيل لا تتحمل الخسارة لا الاقتصادية ولا البشرية ولا الأخلاقية
وعندما يشعر الإسرائيلي أن هناك من يحتل موقع الضحية بدلا منه يفقد صوابه
Palestinian boys throwing stones against Israeli tanks. This David and Goliath contest put the Israelis under great pressure. Time was now of the essence. In an exclusive for Al Jazeera, the Norwegian Foreign Ministry has released highly confidential documents that include a 1988 hand-delivered letter from Foreign Minister Stoltenberg to Israeli Foreign Minister Peres. Stoltenberg wrote that only by relieving itself of the burden of the occupied territories can Israel succeed and prosper.
I am ready to talk with any Palestinian that will renounce terror, that will accept 242 and 338 and recognize Israel. Come and negotiate with us. Then you can claim whatever you want.
88 القيادة الفلسطينية عملت زفة مصطنعة لكن في الواقع كان ياسر عرفات يريد أن يقول نحن نوافق على القرار 242 بس كيف بده يغلفها إنه بصير عنا دولة فعمل دولة في الهواء
قيام دولة فلسطين فوق أرضنا الفلسطينية فوق أرضنا الفلسطينية وعاصمتها القدس الشريف
حين توافق قيادة منظمة التحرير على الـ 242 الذي ظلت تحاربه منذ صدوره في نوفمبر 67 في الواقع شطب كل شيء في القضية الفلسطينية
except all United Nations resolutions including 242 and 338 and I accept the international equality who is against international equality
فبدأ الاقتراب من المجتمع الدولي الذي كان مقاطعاً ومواجهاً لمنظمة التحرير كمنظمة إرهابية بدأ التعامل يختلف
In 1988, Sweden mediated between the PLO and the United States. A public meeting was held in Stockholm.
PLO Parliament, the Palestinian Parliament, the PNC had accepted two states. Palestine state and Jewish state, between brackets, Israel.
In his speech to the UN General Assembly in Geneva in 1988, Arafat formally condemned terrorism.
التي أبو عمار بخطاب جنيف حكى بشكل مغمغ ما عجبش الأمريكان، أنه ما قالش بصراحة أنا أنبذ الإرهاب. فقالوا له بتعمل مؤتمر صحفي تاني يوم بجنيف، وكان هذا أظن ب 14/12/88، وبتقول فيه الكلام الصريح: أنا باسم منظمة التحرير أعلن عن نبذ الإرهاب، بالإنجليزي حتى. فبالمؤتمر الصحفي بلش أبو عمار مش عارف كيف بده يقولها، فصار يقول أول إشي I announce terrorism. فهبوا عليه الصحفيين: لا مش هيك.
As for terrorism,
I announced
yesterday in no uncertain terms, and yet I repeat for the record that we totally and absolutely renounce all forms of terrorism. All forms of terrorism, including individual...
Arafat had accepted the Israeli terms to start terrorism negotiations.
I repeat for the record.
In December 1988, PLO leader Yasser Arafat, known to his colleagues as Abu Ammar, publicly renounced violence.
All forms of terrorism.
Over the years, Norway had discreetly been talking to the PLO. With Arafat renouncing violence, Norway was now ready to pay him an official visit at the PLO headquarters in Tunis.
Tradisjon med et langt og godt forhold til Israel. Og i det arbeidet stilte vi to krav til PLO: at de skulle anerkjenne Israel, og at de skulle ta avstand fra terrorisme. Det gjorde Arafat.
It was the first time a Norwegian foreign minister visited PLO. It was definitely a successful visit because it was a breakthrough for official contacts.
The same foreign minister, Thorvald Stoltenberg, the father of the prime minister of Norway today, he went on a mission to Arafat in Tunis in 1989. And at that meeting, they had a secret part that no one knew about.
The Norwegians worked with Arafat on creating a channel of communication between the PLO and Israel, far from public scrutiny.
Ms. Arafat, first time he explained how he saw contacts with Israel being established. And the idea of using a Norwegian research institution was the idea of Mr. Yasser Arafat, which he outlined during that meeting.
They hadn't planned or decided which research institute in Norway, but they agreed that that would be a good cover. And they also agreed that the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs should pay for it all. That was also agreed in the document.
Fafo was a think tank in Oslo founded by the trade unions and connected to Norway's Labour Party. It was chosen by the Norwegian Foreign Minister as the perfect host for secret talks between Israelis and Palestinians. Its director was Tarja Rod-Larsen. He would go on to become a key figure in the negotiations that led to the Oslo Accords. With funding from the Norwegian Foreign Ministry, in 1989, Fafo started to undertake research in the Middle East. Its first study examined the living conditions in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip.
Den levekårsundersøkelsen som Fafo gjennomførte i okkupert område, som begynte i 1989.
The living condition of young people growing up under the Intifada. What kind of effect on them? Maybe more on the sort of mental, psychological effect of growing up in such sort of a violent environment.
But then it was more a socio-economic study.
It turned out to because that was sort of the speciality of FAFO, so it turned out to be a little more on the sort of more socio-economic, unemployment, all these kinds of indicators of social economic life. Mm.
So who were the researchers that worked on this project from Norway?
Yeah, there were many, and one of them that sort of was heading that special service was Marianne Heiberg, who was the wife of. He wasn't at the time, but he later became the Norwegian Foreign Minister Johan Jørgen Holst. I was working in the sort of what we call the foreign minister's cabinet or the secretariat. My husband was with FAFO. Jan Egeland was the state secretary.
Mona Juul and I had studied political science in the university. We had been skiing together. We had been to university camps together. And her husband, Teirud Larsen, I also knew from his work as an academic and his work in creation of FAFO, the trade union think tank. So these were my friends when I became the deputy of Thorvald Stoltenberg in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
It's often difficult for foreigners to understand that Norway is a very, very small country. And the Labour Party has ruled Norway for the most of the post-war period. So you have connections. You are almost families married together within the Labour Party. Like almost, we sometimes call it the Royal Labour Party because they are like a dynasty.
This dynasty was very tight-knit. Foreign Minister Stoltenberg appointed Jan Egeland as his deputy and Mona Juul as Egeland's secretary. She was married to Tarja Rod Larsen, the director of FAFO. Stoltenberg's sister-in-law was Marianne Heiberg, who worked in FAFO. She was married to Defence Minister Johan Jørgen Holst. This made Holst and the Foreign Minister Stoltenberg brothers-in-law. Holst himself later became Foreign Minister. This extended political family became the Norwegian team in the secret Israeli PLO talks.
They could use that research institution as a front for a diplomatic effort to facilitate peace talks between the two parties and do that in all secrecy.
You are very critical about this. Why?
I think researchers should not usually be take on two hats or be in double roles.
In Tel Aviv, another research institute was also acting as a cover for communication between the Israelis and Palestinians. This was the Economic Cooperation Foundation, set up by Israeli Labour Party MP Yossi Beilin.
An NGO that we were leading, Hirschfeld and myself, an NGO which was created earlier by Beilin and Hirschfeld, we were able to go between the two sides in Jerusalem and pass messages and come with ideas and even bring the two sides unofficially together under our umbrella of an NGO.
I was involved with talking to the Palestinian side for many years in a very informal way, mainly with people like Hanan Ashrawi and Faisal Husseini from East Jerusalem and with whom it was easy to talk.
By 1989, with the Palestinian Intifada in its second year, there were few signs of hope for peace. Hundreds of Palestinians had been killed and thousands detained. The United States, under President George Bush, started to increase the pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir.
The peace process will be composed of two stages. First stage will be an interim conditions
and this will include the full autonomy, etc. The second stage will be direct negotiations without any preconditions between Israel, the Palestinian Arabs, and some Arab countries if they will join the negotiations.
We are ready to embark immediately on peace talks. For that purpose, we are ready to hold elections in the administered territories that will produce a democratically chosen representative leadership of the Palestinians.
Everything changed in the region when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. The United States led a coalition of nations that retaliated against Iraqi forces.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak.
Arafat rejected a military solution to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. This proved a costly decision.
Before the Gulf War, PLO received big financial support from the Arab Gulf states. After the war, because of Yasser Arafat's support to Saddam Hussein, that financial support disappeared. They came out of that war very weakened. And I think, frankly, that was also one of the reasons why the Israelis were more interested in discussing with them after the Gulf War than before. We, of course, have close relations with the United States of America. With an ally, they are a friend, and we made no secret of our contacts with the PLO, obviously, and we shared some of our assessment based on our communication with PLO with our American friends, yes.
In the aftermath of the 1991 Gulf War, the United States and the Soviet Union co-hosted a peace conference in the Spanish capital of Madrid.
We have an opportunity, I think a real opportunity, to see Arabs, Arab states, sitting down face-to-face in direct negotiations with Israel.
Madrid, وكل الشروط التي وضعت وضعتها الحكومة الإسرائيلية بقيادة شامير أيامها إنه ممنوع منظمة التحرير تكون ممثلة ويجب أن يكون الوفد هو من الأراضي الفلسطينية المحتلة
أبو عمار ناوى بكل السبل ما نجحناش وكل العرب يا اللي بدوش إيانا بدو يعزلنا يا اللي بقولنا اقبلوا ووافقوا المهم إنه توضعوا قدم في العملية السياسية نوافق على المشاركة في مؤتمر مدريد من خلال وفد فلسطيني أردني مشترك
من أجل الوصول إلى مؤتمر السلام لأن هذا هو الأمر الأول الذي يشغل بالنا.
The Israelis laid out a fixed negotiating position.
We are the only people who have lived in the land of Israel without interruption for nearly 4,000 years.
Haider Abdeshafi led the Palestinians within the joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation at the talks.
Palestinian Jerusalem, the capital of our homeland and future state, defines Palestinian existence, past, present, and future. The settlements must stop now. Territory for peace is a travesty when territory for illegal settlement is official Israeli policy and practice.
The three-day conference ended with plans for further bilateral and multilateral negotiations between Israel and the Arabs. Documents released after the conference reveal that Shamir thought Madrid a success. And that James Baker said that the US did not support an independent Palestinian state.
الإسرائيليين كانوا واضحين في سلوكهم وتصرفاتهم أنه سوف نتحدث ربما لا 20 عام، لا يعنيهم الأمر كثيرا.
Israelis who celebrated the end of Hanukkah in Washington arrived 5 days late, an attempt to make it clear to the United States that they're here on their own terms and won't respond to pressure.
After Madrid, negotiations moved to Washington, D.C.
We sincerely feel that our ideas are fully in conformity with the framework of this process as it was laid ahead. And we speak with a joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation.
Hello, good evening, everybody. We met like we met in the morning, the heads of delegations. We discussed the matter of procedures, and we could not reach yet an agreement.
The Israeli government shifted unabashed to the intransigent and openly declared position of claiming all Palestinian territory, not conceding anything for the Palestinians, and refusing to recognize their unity, the unity of the Palestinians inside and outside.
الذي كان يسيطر على تفكير حيدر عبد الشافي ليلا نهارا وفي كل مرة اجتمعنا وناقشنا وسمعنا لأحاديث رسمية أو جانبية، الذي كان يسيطر على تفكيره الاستيطان.
And the Israelis, they were more and more angry about this very old, calm, distinguished man talking about settlements. He said, how can we have back Palestine if it's settlements all over? So he had a much more, and the delegation there had a much more straightforward approach to peace.
For the Palestinians, negotiator Haider Abd al-Shafi kept the focus of his agenda on one burning issue: the illegal Israeli settlement construction in the occupied Palestinian territories. By 1991, the number of Israeli settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip exceeded
100,000. فعلا لا تريد السلام لأن المستوطنات غير شرعية وغير قانونية.
وعندما فشل الوفد الإسرائيلي في دفع الفلسطينيين في الوفد الرسمي المفاوض إلى المواقف التي يريدها، بدأوا يبحثوا عن طرق أخرى.
I would say one of the most important messages that we got in our almost daily contacts with Ashrawi and Husseini and Nusseibeh and Ziyad and all the Palestinian leaders: if PLO will not be involved, there won't be any progress. And more so, Ashrawi and Husseini told us very clear. Hanan Ashrawi and Faisal Husseini, they told us something very, very clear. If you would like to have an agreement with the Palestinians, a partner who can make concessions, there's only one address, and this is the PLO.
If the Israelis would like to negotiate with the Palestinians, so they must negotiate with the representative of the Palestinians. The representative of the Palestinians is the PLO.
If they disqualify the PLO, then they're not going to have any Palestinian to talk to.
مفاوضات واشنطن بدأت تدور في فراغ، وصارت الاجتماعات في واشنطن وكأنها اجتماعات روتينية تقليدية. وفد واشنطن راجع، وفد واشنطن عايد مرة ثانية إلى واشنطن، وبدور بنفس الكلام. وأيضا فينا بمفاوضات سرية إنه ندخل بطريقة أكثر عملية وجدية مع الإسرائيليين، وبالنهاية إذا ما وصلنا لشيء ما في شيء بتسجل علينا، يعني لأنه هذه مفاوضات سرية مش ملزمة.
The PLO again approached Norway to open a new and secret channel with the Israelis. In February of 1992, senior PLO official Ahmed Karaya, known as Abu Ala, traveled to Oslo.
أبو علاء كان بالسويد وجا من السويد لهون، رحنا على الخارجية وشفناهم في الخارجية، وطبعا نفس وجهة النظر اللي بديها أبو عمار.
مع مين اجتمعتوا في الخارجية؟
في الخارجية اجتمعنا مع الوزير الخارجية مع ستولتنبرغ، وكان موجود يعني إيكلاند أتذكر كان موجود يعني.
PLO starts to send signals to us here. Abuala comes that we, Norway, could become their link to Israel if Israel was interested. Then came Bassam Abu Sharif, and he was even more explicit and said, I am talking directly, I have a message straight from the top, Yasser Arafat. Norway should try to do this, and it has to be directly linked with PLO Tunis leadership only.
The minutes of their secret meeting in Oslo reveal that Bassam Abu Sharif told the Norwegians that if there were peace, the PLO would influence the Arab world to stop the boycott of Israel.
It takes two to tango. We did not have the Israeli side. I had met Yitzhak Rabin before he was elected on one of my missions to Israel.
On April 1992.
In April 1992, we met Rabin. He came for breakfast in the Norwegian embassy, and we asked him, what is your approach to the Palestinians? And he said, I am keen to see some kind of a negotiated settlement.
In 1992, the Israeli Labour Party, led by Yitzhak Rabin, won the general election. Rabin continued Israel's policy of settlement building. In public, he spoke optimistically of progress in the peace negotiations.
It will be possible to reach an agreement with the Palestinian delegation about the establishment of autonomy.
What will be the first and most important task for a government, for you and your colleagues?
To renew the peace process and to go straight ahead into the autonomy implementation.
Shimon Peres was appointed foreign minister. Yossi Beilin, here on the left, was appointed his deputy, and Uri Savir, on the right, their general manager. Beilin was given the green light to start the secret direct negotiations with the PLO in Norway.
The point about Norway was, because Norway was out of the EU, it had independent foreign policy. We had meetings with Terje Larsen, with his people.
And we had many, many, many meetings, but very little came out of it. But I then started to understand much better the mindset of both parties.
Beilin actually told the Norwegians that it's good that they will make contact with Hirschfeld, later I joined, in order to facilitate, in order to, that you know, that you'll have like two NGOs, two non-governmental dialogue. This was the and we met, Hirschfeld met Larsen before, I met him April and later. We found a brother, in a way, a man who thinks very similar to our way of thinking. His wife was the head of the office of the minister and his deputy. And second is the minister and the deputy were very close friends of Larsen, all of them from the Labour Party, all old friends.
Mr. Stoltenberg was the foreign minister. I knew him very well, and he was very, very enthusiastic about the process.
Mr. Stoltenberg met Shimon Peres, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Israel in New York at the opening of the General Assembly in September. And on the basis of those contacts and follow-up contacts, Thorvald Stoltenberg's assessment was that time was ripe to follow up the suggestion of Mr. Arafat.
The PLO and Arafat were exactly weak enough. So this was exactly the time that the Israelis should choose to start negotiating with PLO outside.
PLO before Oslo was almost dead.
Israel was the strong power, and Israel decided who to talk to, when to talk, the terms of the negotiations. They told Norway that Norway could like it or dislike it. They could do as Israel said, say, or go home.
A new and self-confident Israeli government. and a PLO still cast as outsiders by the world community. They were now on the secret road to the Oslo Accords. But much would need to happen before the diplomatic finale on the White House lawn. In September 1993, Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, also known as Abu Ammar, shook hands on the White House lawn. The negotiations leading here were secret and mediated by Norwegian politicians. The talks were conducted through shadow organizations to maintain secrecy and cover everyone's tracks. The Oslo trade union think tank, Fafo, did a study in the early 90s on the living conditions of Palestinians in occupied territories. But it was a cover for these secret negotiations between the PLO and Israel.
As part of Fafo's standards of living survey that was undertaken in the Palestinian areas, I had authorized money for this project. These were the money that could also fund the talks in Oslo.
Oslo would have not started if, for example, Fafo would have not invited us to go to Norway. I presume that if Fafo would say, pay for yourself, Oslo would have not happened. I mean, this is, you know, funny things, but that's life.
All what we did when it came to stationaries, all the papers were all sort of on Fafo paper in order to leave no traces of any kind of official Norwegian involvement.
Thorvald Stoltenberg decided to use the Norwegian Research Institute, Fafo. Herje Rød Larsen was the head of Fafo at the time, so he also asked me to ask Mr. Arafat to receive Herje Rød Larsen in Tunis.
The parties didn't want to do it directly with the foreign ministry because they wanted to have what they phrased deniability. So in December 1992, I flew to Tunis and met Arafat.
سألوا لأبو عمار أسئلة يعني مو بس يعني عن المستقبل القضية الفلسطينية سألوا عن علاقاته مع القيادات العربية وغير العربية يعني كيف بتشوف موقف الفلاني كيف بتشوف موقف إفلام القضية الفلسطينية كيف بتشوف موقف إيران القضية الفلسطينية كل بالتفاصيل شو موقف الحركات الإسلامية في العالم يعني وبدأ اللقاء الساعة 9 مساء وانتهت 2:30 صباحا أبو عمار ما بيخل عليه ولا بجواب.
In this house, 100 kilometers from Oslo near the Swedish border, two Israelis, three Palestinians and four Norwegians met three times in early 1993. These gatherings led to what later became known as the Oslo Accords.
The Oslo negotiations actually started with two Israelis. One of them is me, the other is Dr. Yair Hirschfeld. We were two academicians with huge knowledge about the history of the conflict. We will always play as if we are representing Beilin and Peres. I had also my contacts within the Labour Party. I knew Yossi Beilin, I knew Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres was a friend of my parents, so I knew him very well.
هم كانوا يحاولون أن يقدموا أنفسهم في البداية على أنهم هم أكاديميين لا علاقة لهم في القرار السياسي لكن هم لهم صداقات في مؤسسة الحكم الإسرائيلية. كان الحديث أنه هذا الوفد هو وفد ممثل لمنظمة التحرير الفلسطيني.
أبو علا came with two people that the Norwegians didn't know and thought that they were his bodyguards. But there were, one is Hassan Asfour, who was from the office of Abu Mazen, and second is Maher El-Kurd, Dr. Maher El-Kurd, who was from the economic, was an economic expert from the office of Abu Ammar, of Arafat.
The whole negotiations language was in English.
Yeah, and whenever the Palestinian felt that they need to say something which is more accurate in Arabic, they talked in Arabic and was translated to English by Maher El-Kurd, and we, both of us, we know a bit Arabic, so we could also assist.
وفي اثنين ثلاثة يعني أبو مازن أبو عمار وأنا هم الذين يعرفون عن هذه المفاوضات في تونس.
In the Norwegian government, it must have been three or four people. the Prime Minister, myself, and the Defense Minister. But that was all.
We had a meeting with Thorvald Stoltenberg in his office. He said, nobody present, none of you will be involved at all.
Who were you?
Well, we were four people from our ministry. I will not name the others, but I was one of them. And this was again a matter of deniability.
The Norwegian team, which was based on mainly on the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Jan Egeland, his right hand, Mona Juul, the wife of Tari Larsen, and Tari Larsen.
We started talking about very private things. Families, sons, how they grew up, their wives, their kids, and in order to have them to relate to each other as human beings, they had to live in the same house, had breakfast, lunch, dinner together, and not leave the premises for the time that they were there.
بتوفير الأجواء، بتوفير المكان، بتوفير متطلبات يعني نجاح مفاوضات وتسهيل الدخول والخروج بشكل أولاً لائق وبشكل غير يعني بعيد عن كل وسائل الإعلام. فبالتالي النرويج لعبت هذا الدور حقيقة بعتقد بكفاءة.
I briefed and cleared with my boss Thorvald Stoltenberg that we could do this, and I kept him updated throughout the talks, but he did not participate in any of the talks.
When they went back, we were very active, both on the phone, in order then, because they didn't speak to each other then, so we were sort of, the messages growing through to the two of them went sort of through us. And of course, we also then tested out certain things, either for the Palestinian to the Israelis and vice versa. Maybe do you think you could accept if we did like this or we do like this, and these kind of things.
They were able to play, these very senior three people, the role of a soldier and of a general. Meaning, if we needed coffee, the deputy minister of foreign affairs would have come with coffee. If we needed an idea, he would come with an idea. If we needed that somebody would speak with Foreign Minister Christopher, State Department, so the same man who brought us coffee was also able to speak with Christopher, which is, from our point of view, was a classical environment, allowing us to dictate what should be their role. And it was perfect. It was the best.
In his book, The New Middle East, Shimon Peres wrote, "The Norwegians were a gift from heaven." After the first round of talks, the Israelis began drafting what they called a declaration of principles.
The second meeting, which took place some 3-4 weeks later, was, from my point of view, the most crucial meeting to make this meeting of two sides into a channel. And what happened then was that we came with a paper.
Was discussed with Bailyn?
Bailyn saw the paper and endorsed it.
The logic of Oslo is that you started with the easiest and then you postponed the most difficult, hoping that the parties would find a way as they walked that road to resolve the more difficult issues.
All the difficult questions, security, Jerusalem, Palestinian refugees, borders, you name it, all of them were taken out. And they should not be discussed.
قيل في حينها وهذه تم المناقشة يعني بعمق حولها إنه هذه القضايا طرحها سوف لن يترك مجالا للتوافق.
What should then be discussed? It was self-rule for the Palestinians in Gaza and in the small city of Jericho, and it was self-rule on certain, I think, 5. Specific areas as education, tourism, health, and so on.
فعلا هذا ما قلنا انه اذا هذا هو اللي بدكم اياه اذا انتم بدكم تبقوا على الاحتلال وتغيروا الشكل الفاقع انه كمحتل الى دور انه في يعني موجودين فلسطينيين يديروا شؤونهم الداخليه تحت سياده هذا الاحتلال يعني طبعا يعني هذا حقيقه ما كانوا يفاوضوا على اساسه.
We are ready to let the Palestinians run their own life in their own environment, have a self-government.
To solve in Oslo the problems that we had in the negotiations in Washington, which led us to nowhere.
My counterpart, Yossi Beilin, whom I kept contact with, saw that enormous progress was made in the talks with Abu Alla, who was a real leader on the PLO side and would not have made his concessions without Yasser Arafat knowing and clearing it. Abu Mazen was also involved throughout.
The talks continued in Sarpsborg near Oslo, 2 days a month. Meanwhile, the official public negotiations in Washington, D.C. came to an abrupt halt when Israel expelled 400 Palestinians to Marj al-Zuhur in southern Lebanon.
كان أبو عمار يعني يطلب منا دائما أنه نذهب لمصر لوضع المصريين وخاصة دكتور أسامة البازي اللي كان مستشار لرئيس مبارك أيامها.
El-Baz sent word to Tel Aviv that Arafat approved Israel's first proposal that the PLO could have a foothold in the Gaza Strip and Jericho.
Specifically, the message related to the peace process. I will not go beyond that.
What we reached in the first 4 months was a document which we called the Sarpsborg document, which was, from our point of view, a pre-negotiation document. We never thought that this document could be signed. The Palestinians thought that maybe.
I asked the American embassy in Oslo to fix me up with a secure line to State Department. So I went up there and had updated them 2-3 times on progress towards the Sarpsborg, the initial draft agreement.
That was February 1993.
It was February and March and April where we did these things. And Thorvald Stoltenberg even gave the original draft, first version of the Oslo Agreement, if you like, to Warren Christopher. And he was very interested in this.
Hello, how are you?
U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher was monitoring both the secret Oslo and the official Washington negotiations. The Israelis decided after 18 months that the Washington talks were not going to reach agreement.
The United States is prepared, along with our co-sponsors, the Russian government, to play our role as partners in this process, to assist in any way we can the parties to move these negotiations forward.
We are always for anything that would make life easier, provided security and calm are sustained.
You don't know how frustrated we are. We came here with strong nerves, with to show our intention about peace, but certainly we cannot bear the responsibility of continuing with the peace process that's not promising anything.
كان هناك إصرار على التمسك بالموقف الصارم الفلسطيني، وطبعا لم يكن أحد يعرف أن هناك مفاوضات أخرى تجري.
Nobody knew anything about the channel, and whenever there was some knowledge, we immediately jointly were able to quiet it.
We were, of course, criticized for this secrecy. But without the secrecy, it would not have worked at all.
The Norwegian Prime Minister announcing the departure of her foreign minister, about to begin a new role as UN peacemaker.
I have many friends in former Yugoslavia. I hope that I shall be able to contribute to a peaceful solution. I didn't really want to go to Balkan. And that was because I would like to see the Oslo process through, because I was then very optimistic.
Stoltenberg's successor as foreign minister was his brother-in-law, former defense minister Johan Jürgen Holst. Holst had been a strong supporter of Israel since the early 70s.
Johan Jürgen Holst was very keen. He asked for us to do whatever we could to make progress. He had already had signals from Terje, Bert Larsen and Mona Juul, who of course knew him well through Marianne Heiberg, his wife, who worked at Fafo.
He knew enough, and I briefly informed him, but I was also sending him messages when he asked, and he did some in the beginning. I sent it from Balkan to him, but he was by and large informed.
This channel was upgraded in May. That was after Mr. Holst had become Minister of Foreign Affairs.
The Israelis also introduced a new face at the Oslo talks. Their general manager at the Foreign Ministry, Uri Sevir.
When Foreign Minister Peres asked me to look at this document and then potentially participate in this channel, I was very glad. I think that something good had happened to the PLO. They finally began to see that the armed struggle will lead them nowhere. That actually their biggest enemy is their biggest ally and partner, Israel.
They met for the first time up at a sort of small cottage up at Holmenkollen, which is a famous ski jump and a ski area in just right outside Oslo. Abola slept at Holmenkollen Park Hotel, which is a hotel next door.
And Uri Sevir, where did he stay?
I think he stayed in our flat that night. That's right, yeah.
I'm a big believer in secret negotiations. So at the end, the public knows the outcome and not the intermediary concessions. And therefore, we knew we had about 2-3 months. And in 3 months, we did it.
In this hotel near Oslo, Uri Sevir used his first meeting with the Palestinians to stress 3 deal-breaking Israeli conditions. First, no negotiations over Jerusalem or the return of refugees. Second, no UN involvement or international arbitration. And third, that the public-facing Washington talks continue in parallel with the secret negotiations. The Palestinians accepted all 3.
بدأ سفير مرة أخرى يعصر في الجانب الفلسطيني ويحصل على مجموعة جديدة من التنازلات وعندما انتهى قالوا لهم ولكن إحنا من خارجية وهدول الخارجية يتبعوا لشمعون بيرس لازم نجيب حد الآن من مكتب رابين فأرسلوا أشرس المفاوضين وهو شمويل زينجر.
جويل سينجر's contribution was to ask hundreds of questions on the other side to really understand what this would mean. How PLO would treat this, what would be them as a counterpart. They, I think, felt it was quite offensive in one way to be interrogated like that.
من ضمنها أسئلة تشكل أفخاخ مثل هل توافقوا على بقاء المستوطنين في المناطق التي ستديرونها وعندما حصل على جواب نعم يعني طار من الفرح لأنه هذا معناته قبول بوجود الاستيطان. وفي النهاية زينجر نفسه كتب قال أنا لم أفاجأ بحصولي على 100 جواب على 100 سؤال ما فوجئت به أنني لم أتلقى مع 100 جواب ولا سؤال فلسطيني واحد.
Lawyer Joel Singer acted as a legal advisor to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. Following his first meeting with the Palestinians, he headed to Vienna to meet Peres.
Shimon Peres came back from a dinner. And Yoel wakes up, and he looks at him, and I say, Yoel, he said, Foreign Minister, if we don't make an immediate deal with these people, we are complete idiots.
5 months later, in July 1993, in the resort of Halvorsball, Singer presented the amended Declaration of Principles document, setting out the details of Palestinian autonomy. It clearly stated that autonomy wouldn't include the settlements, military zones, or Jerusalem, and that Israel would remain in charge of security and the protection of settlers.
So what Yoel Singer did, he deconstructed it, made it into a document with legal aspect. The Palestinians, one should understand, were shocked. Because suddenly, all things that they were saying, but they were afraid to see them, were black and white. And it was a tough day for them.
The Palestinian delegation saw the serious implications of Singer's document and so returned to Tunis to confer with the PLO leadership.
Arafat wanted to enlarge the Jericho area into the Jordan River so he would have certain hold on his relationship with Jordan. That was quite an argument. Then certain authorities of the council, etc. And like in every negotiations comes the end game. And the end game was conducted by Holst going to Tunis.
Tunis klokken 4 om morgenen fredag i forrige uke.
Gjennom فهو جاء الى تونس لمقابله الشيخ ابو عمار وانا كنت في ذلك اللقاء ليطلع منه وخرج ليقول عرفات اكثر حرصا ودعما للوصول الى اتفاق حتى من ابو علاء ومن ابو مازن ومن الاخرين يعني وبالتالي هو جاد جدا واكد ذلك للاسرائيليين.
It was very very useful then to have the opportunity to discuss these issues also directly with Arafat and we were then sort of also able to communicate that to the Israelis.
After these meetings with Arafat, Kari Larsen and Mona Juul went back to Jerusalem to the whole Israeli team and told the Israelis everything that Arafat had said and done.
And even a letter written by Holst himself.
Not even a letter. A letter and, I think, 11 pages with minutes from the meeting, giving the letter and the minutes, word by word, of Arafat's opinions, where he thought he can have something or lose something. All this was given to the Israelis.
It was more sort of a judgment on where the Palestinians and Arafat in particular were on sort of the whole idea of reaching an agreement. Johan Jørgen Holst was very much a writing man. He always wrote things and he wrote almost everything himself. I mean, working for him was very difficult than working with other ministers because he every time when he went to meetings and the first thing on the plane, he sat down and he wrote down his impressions, and so that was the way sort of he worked. So it was very much a personal letter.
So this letter was handed to Mr. Peres at that time?
Yeah.
Extracts of these letters later appeared in personal memoirs. But no official record of their contents has ever been found in the Norwegian Foreign Ministry. In the secret negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel, Norway's role as mediator was key. But those involved were careful always to cover their tracks.
In the new books of Shimon Peres, Foreign Minister of Israel, Yossi Beilin, Deputy Foreign Minister of Israel, Uri Shavir, Chief Negotiator of Israel, and so on, there were many paragraphs quoting from secret Norwegian documents, letters that they, for instance, had received from the Norwegian Foreign Minister. But still, in the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, no copies, nothing. From the period of 20th of January, when it started, until the end of August, it was nothing. It was no documents, no memos, just nothing from what had actually been going on in this secret Oslo project. We found out that Terje Larsen, he has admitted that he has many of these secret documents himself. and he refuses to give them back to the Norwegian state.
To do secret negotiations through a ministry is very difficult, because there has to be written reports, lots of people will have to know about it. If you do it with a research institute, you can have just a tiny little group of people, and there's no duty to report in writing. So, and this is also how the secrecy was kept.
The secret Holst-Perez conversations led them to believe that the time had come to finalize a deal. Perez headed to Stockholm to resolve the outstanding points on the phone.
At the castle in Sweden, we are opening actually a hotline.
Perez invites
the Norwegian foreign minister and Tarje Larsen and Mona Juul to be the go-between. They're sitting in the room together with Joel Zinger. Arafat and his team are in Tunis.
في ليلة الاتفاق على أوسلو بعام 93 دعانا أبو عمار بالليل أنه فوراً بدي إياكم أجاني شيء من أبو علاء ومن جماعة أوسلو. إحنا كنا وقتها متزعلين مع أبو عمار أبو مازن وأنا في زعل. كان موارد المنظمة أصبحت شحيحة، فأبو عمار وقف الصف على كل شيء بما في ذلك يعني أجرات بيوتنا وتليفوناتنا. نسينا كل الخلاف وذهبنا لعنده.
من كان حاضرا في تونس؟
كنا حاضرين في اللقاء هذاك 4 أو 5، أبو عمار، أبو مازن، أبو علاء، حسن عصفور، كان في شخص لبناني مقرب لنا محسن إبراهيم كان قاعد مشارك. فأبو عمار كان يحكي مع هولست.
Also was talking to Yasser Arafat. And Peres could hear on the phone for the first time Arafat and his people. And this is this, they solved 6 out of 7 issues.
All the outstanding issues from the 6 rounds of secret negotiations in June and July in Norway were resolved in this 7-hour phone call between Stockholm and Tunis. In his book, Mahmoud Abbas later recalled, "A 7-hour phone call ended the conflict of the 20th century. The Palestinian people took their first steps towards freedom and emancipation. That call achieved what couldn't be done in 20 months of futile negotiations in Washington."
فأوسلو لم يتضمن لا كلمة إنهاء الاحتلال، إنهاء الاستيطان، ولا كلمة دولة فلسطينية مستقلة. ترك الباب مفتوح. وكل هذا بحجة أنه يعني حتى يقدروا يمرروا هذا المشروع على قياداتهم بما في رابين تحديدا. طبعا كل غموض، حتى نكون يعني موضوعيين، كل غموض هو في صالح الطرف الأقوى دائما. الطرف الأضعف هو الذي يسعى دائما للوضوح.
If you have a strong and a weak party, the strong party is the strongest. This is the reality of the world. And if then you have a strong party that is backed by the superpower of the world, the United States, it makes that strong party even stronger.
In this government guest house in Oslo, and in absolute secrecy, the Declaration of Principles was initialed by both sides. The secret signing was filmed by Norwegian intelligence, and the footage later used in a documentary for public TV in Norway.
Abu Ala being much more emotional than we had thought. I mean, he felt this was astronomic in a way, that he would be greeted by one of the leaders of official Israel.
Utenriksråd Avi Gill, sammen med Uri Savir, forhandlingsleder og departementsråd i UD, Peres juridiske rådgiver Joel Singer, delegasjonsmedlemmer Jair Hirschfeldt og professor Ron Pundik. Seremonien bevåkes av Holsts hustru Marianne Heiberg.
After midnight, the negotiators come to the government guest house, and then Shimon Peres is a witness as the official initialing happens with Uri Savir and Abu Alla signing this. Johan Jürgen Holst, Mona Terje and I stand there behind them.
We had then our, what we call the secret police at the time, then doing sort of the filming or the video of it, and we had sort of prepared the little speeches.
We feel proud that this happened in Norway, and we hope that now that you enter into a new period of cooperation, openness, of building down all barriers and building up new cooperative arrangements and structures, that you will remember that we are always there. If you ever again will need our services, but the task is yours.
On the first step of opening the doors of peace and on striving to achieve cooperation,
your people are lucky to have leaders like you. Mr. Peres, you're also lucky to have a voice like this working with you.
Shimon Peres and Mr. Holst and two of his staffers and Mona Jewel and myself, we flew secretly to a military base in August 1993 Point Magoo in California.
I mean, such a relief. Because Warren Christopher sort of looked at it. Then he turned to Dennis Ross and he said, "Dennis, what do you think?" And then Dennis said, "I think this is great." And then I think sort of all of us sort of had a sigh of relief.
The Declaration of Principles said that the goal of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations was to establish a Palestinian authority for a transitional period of up to 5 years. It would begin with the Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and Jericho, and Israeli forces were to be redeployed outside the populated areas. The final negotiations were to start in year three. Israel was to continue to be responsible for external security, the safety of settlements, and the overall safety of the Israelis.
حين فضح الأمر يعني زي صبيت مي باردة على الوفد المفاوض ولا سيما المرحوم حيدر عبد الشافي.
Haider Abd al-Shafi asked the Palestinian negotiating team's legal advisor in Washington, Francis Boyle, to assess the declaration wording published in the newspapers. Boyle replied that it was the same declaration of principles that they'd rejected in Washington. "It's a limited autonomy of the inhabitants," he said, "without any control over the land." Abd al-Shafi sent Boyle's comments to Arafat, but he never received a reply.
This is a mixture of previous self-rule agreements that the Palestinian leadership in the occupied territories always refused signing. And I think Edward Said said it in a couple of articles that he wrote in Arabic and English before the signing took place. And I think he was deeply shocked having read the Declaration of Principles.
In these articles, Edward Said wrote that the PLO had reduced itself from a national liberation movement to a small municipality. It was what he called the decay of the PLO leadership against the cunning of Israel.
كل الذي صار
باختصار شديد إنه الحاكم العسكري الإسرائيلي نقل صلاحيات الإدارة المدنية إلى الحكم الذاتي الفلسطيني.
بدل ما أنا أخاطب إسرائيلي على شباك الإدارة، أنا أخاطب فلسطيني، والفلسطيني يشكل حلقة وصل بيني وبين الإسرائيلي.
اتفاق أوسلو كان أكبر فكرة عبقرية في تاريخ إسرائيل، لأنه ضمن استمرار الاحتلال دون أن تدفع إسرائيل تكاليف الاحتلال.
After the news of the secret Oslo negotiations had been leaked, it was inevitable that the two sides would bring things into the public arena. Israel started to use the Norwegians to demand further concessions.
بعتوا صيغة هي صيغة غير عادلة وغير متوازنة. إنه إحنا بنعترف إسرائيل، بس إسرائيل بتعترفش بفلسطين كدولة، بتعترف بالمنظمة كممثل للشعب الفلسطيني.
To complete the mutual recognition, Israel stipulated that the PLO not only renounce terrorism, but also commit to prevent all forms of violence and terrorism. And it encouraged the Palestinians to have a normal relationship with Israel from now on. Arafat agreed, and Holst flew to Tunis to witness Arafat signing these letters.
Yes, you had signed it.
Yes.
From my point of view, the exchange of letters are more important than the agreement itself, because the exchange of letters is doing the historical shift.
The Norwegians celebrated with Peres and Sevier in Israel. Rabin announced that based on the PLO's commitments, Israel now recognized the PLO and agreed to negotiate with them. Back in Tunis, the PLO established the Palestinian Authority, which would gradually become the umbrella organization for the Palestinians.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Arafat, Chairman of the Executive Council of the Palestine Liberation Organization, His Excellency Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister of Israel, the President of the United States.
بفضل تأييد المجتمع الدولي وأخص هنا بالذكر الحكومة الولايات المتحدة الأمريكية التي يقع على عاتقها الاستمرار في لعب دور فعال ومميز في المرحلة القادمة من أجل استكمال هذا الإنجاز العظيم.
إحنا كنا يعني الإدارة الأمريكية لم تكن تتعامل معنا إطلاقا. بعد هذا الاتفاق بدأت تتعامل والغرب كله بدأ يتعامل.
The doors are opening for Yasser Arafat at the U.S. State Department. Champagne and laughter, swapping autographs with the Israelis and handshakes with Secretary of State Christopher.
They understood that if they have an agreement with Israel, it will bring them closer to Washington. And we understood that if you make an agreement, it can be gradual, and it will open up relations to the Arab world. We'll have better relations with Egypt, with Jordan. It was a strategic deal.
We were accepted by the world. Relations between us and Arab world moved dramatically. Interest officers, embassies, etc., etc. This immediately allowed the Jordanians to enter into serious negotiation with Israel, leading a year later into a peace agreement between us and Jordan. We were accepted with the Palestinians to all sorts of forums and forums that we were not accepted before. Huge investments came to Israel. Mega companies, Intel, Chinese, Japanese, everybody came.
Johann Jürgen Holst died 4 months later.
Johann Holst and Norway played an essential part in helping to turn the Middle East from a cauldron of hostility into a cradle of hope.
Later in 1994, Arafat, Peres and Rabin were all awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo. Muna Juul was moved to the Norwegian embassy in Israel and her husband, Tarje Rod Larsen, to the UN working for the Palestinians. Responsibility for monitoring the terms of Oslo therefore now passed to the Israeli army.
Not only we were not invited to negotiate, but I would say that also our advice at that time was evaporating somewhere. Even Yossi Beilin was a bit pushed aside. not only us. It was given more to the military, more to the army, more to the security services.
The military leadership of Israel was, for the first time, exposed to Palestinians in negotiations.
يعني ببساطة التنسيق الأمني أن يصبح الفلسطيني وكيلاً أمنياً لإسرائيل. وهذا النص واضح إنه على السلطة الفلسطينية أن تلاحق الإرهاب والإرهابيين. وأيضاً لا تسائل العملاء والجواسيس، ممنوع مساءلتهم أو طردهم من وظائفهم أو ما شابه ذلك.
اللي علينا عملناه، اعتراف متبادل وعملناه، وتنسيق أمني عملناه، كل التزاماتنا طبقناها. هو اللي عليه إنه يعمل، هو المحتل.
الطموح كان أن نصل إلى اتفاق ينهي الاحتلال ويعيد الحقوق الوطنية الفلسطينية للشعب الفلسطيني. إذا لم يتحقق ذلك بلا شك إنه هذا إخفاق.
مثل ياسر عرفات، he gave too many concessions too easily. People got used to him giving up. By the end, there was nothing more to give, and they expected him to give more.
Thank you very much, Mr. Benami, and let's meet again in the next round of negotiation.
לקבל ערובה זו לפירוז ולסידורי ביטחון הדרושים לישראל, ואם הפלסטינים יכירו בישראל כמדינת העם היהודי, נהיה מוכנים בהסדר שלום אמיתי להגיע לפתרון של מדינה פלסטינית מפורזת לצד המדינה היהודית.
انظر الآن נתניהו حتى الآن استعمل الاصطلاح دولة فلسطينية عدة مرات، دائما كل دولة فلسطينية منزوعة السلاح. لم يكن ولا بأي مرة من المرات دولة فلسطينية مستقلة ذات سيادة، لأنه يعرف معنى ذلك وهو لا يقصد ذلك إطلاقا. عندما يقول حل الدولتين ودولة منزوعة السلاح، هو يقصد أنه سيتواجد في غور الأردن عسكريا وبالتالي لا يوجد سيادة.
Illegal Israeli settlement of the West Bank has continued since 1993. Palestinians believe that the Oslo Accords ultimately benefited Israel more than themselves, and that this expansion on the ground is part of the price they have paid for Oslo. Dror Etkes is an Israeli expert on the settlements, and he tracks their development. The West Bank constitutes one-fifth the area of historic Palestine. Today, more than 300,000 Israeli settlers live in the West Bank, not counting the 200,000 in East Jerusalem.
The Oslo Agreement is actually the best thing which happened to the Israeli settlers and the Israeli settlement enterprise, because it created exactly the basic conditions which this kind of project can bloom in. While the Palestinian population was supposedly taken care of by the PA, and there was supposedly some kind of a peace process conducted between the PLO and Israel, 60% of the West Bank remain open for Israeli development. This is exactly what you see here. It's a period which Israel had intensively and effectively used in order to over triple the number of Israeli settlers in the West Bank, and to change completely, irreversibly, the West Bank landscape. Another good example is, of course, the bypass system, which is just under us. This old bypass system was created after Oslo. There were the years between 1993 and 2000, which the Israeli population growth in the West Bank reached the fastest pace of growth ever. It was these years that the entire, almost the entire, bypass system of the West Bank, the parallel road system, the parallel water system, the parallel electricity system, was built in the West Bank. They actually hardly have to see any Arabs today in their commuting, on a daily commuting between the settlement and Jerusalem. One cannot underestimate how important the bypass system was for the development of this old suburban reality which was created in the West Bank. And the Baiba system, effective, modern, efficient transportation infrastructure, is the precondition for the development of this kind of communities.
في فرق بين استيطان يجري ضدك وتكافحي ضده وبين استيطان يجري ضدك وانت جالسه معهم على طاوله المفاوضات تعطيهم الغطاء.
Jews should have the right to enter Israel and to become citizens. This is my view as a Zionist. Now, if there is a majority of Palestinians under our rule, this is the end of this Zionist idea.
Israel واضح انه بالنسبه لها الضفه الغربيه لن تتخلى عنها. واضح. كل اللي بهمها انه هذا العدد السكاني حوالي مليونين انها تتخلص منه. كل الاستراتيجيه الاسرائيليه تتمحور حول هاتين النقطتين، زياده في الاستيطان واستثناء في العنصر السكاني. طبقا لمعايير القانون الدولي اي شعب يقع تحت الاحتلال وتلزم سلطة الاحتلال بالتوقيع على أي اتفاقيات تمس حقوقه فهي اتفاقية باطلة بطلانا مطلقا طبقا لاتفاقيات جنيف.
إسرائيل هي التي كسبت من أصله. أنا لا أوافق أبدا أنه اتفاق أصله فشل أو نجح، أنه فاشل أو ناجح. هو اتفاق أصله فاشل تماما بالنسبة لأهداف الفلسطينيين، ولكنه كان ناجحا تماما بالنسبة لأهداف الإسرائيليين. صحيح في فائدة واحدة جرت من أصله، وهي أنه رجوع أعداد من الفلسطينيين إلى الضفة الغربية حوالي 100,000، هذا إنجاز. ولكن خسائرنا أكبر من ذلك بكثير. خسرنا وحدتنا، خسرنا المشروع الوطني الجامع، خسرنا دور منظمة التحرير وحركة التحرر الوطني لصالح السلطة اللي كلها تحت الاحتلال، وخسرنا زمن، خسرنا 20 عام.